tight with emotion. Henry rolled his eyes.
Oh, for heaven's sake. It was just a silly game from when we were infants. But Figgy needed me, and I could not let her down, he said.
His father put out a hand to Henry's shoulder. Henry rolled his eyes again, but did not shrug him off.
You wore garments you had collected upon your travels in Egypt, but your souvenirs wouldn't have extended to something as curious as the head of Anubis. So Miss Tiverton fashioned one, using her skills with papier-mâché to create the great jackal head for you to wear,
Stoker supplied, picking up the thread easily.
I imagine it had to be papier-mâché in order to make it light enough to wear, a modern-day interpretation of the cartonnage used by the ancients.
Henry nodded his head miserably.
You are to be commended, Miss Tiverton, Stoker said. I cannot think that such a thing would be easy to sculpt, particularly on the first try.
His gaze and voice were gentle, but Figgy erupted into a fresh bout of weeping.
It wasn't her first try,
Henry said with grim resolve.
She made one earlier, back in Egypt, for Patrick Fairbrother.
For what purpose? I demanded.
The same as mine, to masquerade as the god,
he told us. His hand dropped absently to Figgy's shoulder.
Her father asked her to do it. He spun her some cock-and-bull story about native superstition and how the workers were getting restless. He told her they would settle down if they feared Anubis, so Patrick was to stalk around a bit and wave his arms and put the fear of the old gods into them. She did as he asked. Of course she did,
Stoker said. She raised her tear-stained face and looked to him.
I should have refused, she whispered.
Few of us can resist the persuasions of a beloved parent,
he told her. So Fairbrother wore the first mask to frighten the workers, I prodded.
He said they were out of hand, giving trouble, and he wanted to hire new men from upriver, but that it would cause all sorts of problems if he simply let them all go. But if they were frightened away, then they would leave of their own accord, and he would be free to take on whoever he liked. It made sense at the time, she insisted.
Of course it did, Stoker soothed. But if your father and Fairbrother were behind the tricks in Egypt, why repeat them here? Why turn the tables on them?
Figgy's expression was mulish.
Because I wanted to give Patrick a fright. He continued masquerading as Anubis here in London in order to prop up the story of a curse. He pretends to think it's ridiculous, but he really wants people to believe it. I overheard him say it would bring heaps more attention to the exhibition if people believe in that nonsense. He's awful, she said, her voice nearly breaking. I hate him. He's always played up to Papa, acting like he's a member of the family, and he's not. He's hired help, she said, fairly spitting the word. And I know he is up to something with her.
She could not bring herself to say the name, but I knew precisely whom she meant.
Your stepmother? What makes you think so? I saw her one day, coming out of Patrick's room. She was perfectly furtive. She would have seen me, only I was reading behind the curtains and she never noticed I was there.
There might be an innocent explanation, I began.
I think not, she replied in a lofty tone. She is up to something nefarious.
Is that why you followed her to the linen draper? I asked with some asperity. To witness for yourself the perfidy of a lady purchasing her own handkerchiefs?
Oh!
Two spots of bright colour rose in her cheeks.
You are horrid, she told me. I don't care if you don't believe me. I never expected you would.
She said nothing more, but set her mouth in a stubborn line and folded her arms over her chest. We deduced that Figgy was behind the sculpting of the mask, when we learnt of her skills at papier-mâché, I told Horace Steele. But we did not know the identity of her partner in the masquerade until I found the sketch her mother made when they were children and read her account of their first friendship.
Indeed,
Steele said faintly.
Until Henry went away to school, they were always together, every dig, scrambling over rocks, pretending to run their own excavations. They painted on rocks and made their own tombs. Even made their own mummies out of papier-mâché when they learnt about cartonnage. And you knew what they were doing, Stoker said. You knew Henry was masquerading in London as Anubis and that he was doing it with Figgy's help.
Steele held up a hand.
I most certainly did not. I might have had a suspicion, but knowing and suspecting are two different things. I don't ask questions if I think the answer is something I don't want to know, Mr. Templeton Vane.
I turned to Henry. I am rather curious how you managed to assume the disguise so quickly last night, and then resume your own clothes with such haste. He had the grace to flush deeply.
Figgy made certain one of the storerooms was open for me. She hid the costume in there and kept my own clothes waiting for me. And the head was dropped next to the sewers, so that you shouldn't be caught with it. No doubt Figgy was able to give you detailed information about Carnac Hall, and your interest in the drains of London made an excellent cover for your study of the sewers surrounding the hall. No one would connect quiet Henry Steele, with his fondness for all things hygiene, with a god disappearing beneath the city.
Stoker supplied.
Very clever. It wasn't,
Henry said miserably.
It was a stupid thing to do, and you and Miss Speedwell might have been badly hurt. I'm dreadfully sorry.
But we did not come merely to accuse Henry Steele of masquerading as Anubis, I said, turning a stern eye to his father. I held out my hand. The diadem, if you please. He sighed and went to the mantel. The rather hideous painting of the deerhound swung open at a touch. Behind it was a small wall safe, neatly fitted and thoroughly discreet.
The latest in hotel security,
Steele the elder told us as he turned the knob to the left and then the right.
Most establishments insist that guests send their jewels and money down to the manager to be held in the main vault. But the Allerdale is a mite more luxurious than that. Private safes in every room,
he said, opening the small steel door with obvious satisfaction. He withdrew a bundle of white linen, and as he approached, I realized what it was. You wrapped it in your shirt? He gave me an apologetic smile.
It is all I had to hand, Miss Speedwell. Besides, I could have wrapped this coronet in rags and it wouldn't have done it any harm.
Because it is so intrinsically valuable? I asked.
No,
he replied with a grim look as he thrust it into my hands.
Because it is a fake.
Chapter 18. I beg your pardon. I blinked, looking from the American millionaire to the heap of gold resting in my hands. A fake?
Yes, indeed. A clever one, but a fake nonetheless. I realized it as soon as I saw the cartouche. There is an error in the hieroglyphics.
Figgy looked to him in confusion.
But that is the crown of Princess Ankerset. It was taken from her tomb.
No, it wasn't,
Stoker said, working it out.
Or rather, it was taken from the cave your father was excavating, but only because he put it there first.
I don't understand, she said stubbornly.
My God.
Henry Steele breathed, putting a hand to her shoulder.
He faked the expedition.
That was why Patrick Fairbrother was tasked with scaring away the local workers. Those men would have known the goods did not come from the tomb. That is also why he chose to quarrel with you, Mr. Steele, I said, turning to the elder Steele. You were partners, but he knew you would not stand for such a deception. He found the perfect site for the scheme in his remote cave, but it was located in your concession. He had to force you out of the partnership in order to carry out his plan. No! Figgy wailed, but from the sudden collapse of her shoulders, I realized she knew the truth. Tell me, Mr. Steele, I said, why did you quarrel with Sir Leicester? He hesitated, then burst out.
I suppose it can do no harm to tell you now. He insulted my son,
he told us, raising his chin.
No man gets away with calling my boy names.
What provoked him to do that? I pressed. Henry Steele sighed, coloring as he stared at the toes of his shoes.
I confronted him about breaking off the partnership with my father. It bothered father something terrible, and I was angry, really angry. So I went to Sir Leicester and told him it was an ungentlemanly thing to abandon a partner of so many years without a good reason. I called him a blackguard and told him he didn't deserve to have father for a partner. I oughtn't to have done it.
He finished miserably.
Of course you ought to have,
his father countered swiftly.
You put your neck out for one of your own, and that's what Steeles do.
His chest seemed to swell a little as he regarded his son.
But Leicester didn't see it that way. He stopped me in the lobby at Shepherd's and had his say, calling my boy all kinds of names, and I got tired of listening. So I pulled out my revolver to persuade him I meant business when I told him to hush. The newspapers got hold of the story and made it out like I was threatening him. I didn't bother to correct them. I just wanted the whole sorry mess to go away.
Figgy's head shot up and she looked at Henry.
But why did you never tell me?
Because if I had, I would have had to tell you exactly what your father said to me when I spoke with him. And those words are not befitting of a gentleman,
he said with quiet dignity.
It would have grieved you to know exactly what happened. Far better to think that our fathers had just fallen out over the concession.
Henry, she said, coloring furiously, we've been friends forever. You're awfully stupid if you think I wouldn't believe you.
He blinked in surprise behind his spectacles, looking like a beleaguered owl, but Stoker and I exchanged knowing glances. Figgy might protest, but her loyalty to her father was still paramount. She had a child's hero worship for the man, and I pitied her the day she would find his feet were, like all men's, made of clay. After all the revelations of Henry's derring do, Horace Steele was looking at his son with something like admiration.
I am rather surprised to find you had it in you, son. There is a bit of steel in your spine after all,
he added with a grin. Henry rolled his eyes.
Of all the errant nonsense.
I held up a hand. Perhaps you could sort that out later. We are trying to piece together a conspiracy. Sir Leicester secured the concession in Egypt with the intention of salting the site, that is, filling the tomb with fake artifacts he could pretend to excavate and later sell on to unsuspecting collectors. But how could he have got fake antiquities past the Egyptian authorities? I wondered. Surely they would have known he was smuggling out forgeries.
Not if he gave them authentic items,
Horace Steele said thoughtfully.
That is how I would do it if I were to concoct such a plan.
Pa!
Henry Steele's tone was one of reproach.
I said if,
his father pointed out.
Lester, like all excavators, has a substantial collection of his own. He could carry it out to Egypt in the guise of excavation equipment, household goods, and so forth, and when the authorities came calling, he could just hand those pieces over and pretend they had been hauled from the cave. Even if the authorities were suspicious, they would have been satisfied with a bribe of any half-decent artifacts.
So Sir Leicester secures the empty tomb, carries out to Egypt the necessary artifacts to fool the authorities, and purchases cheap fakes to be shipped home in place of the grave goods he never actually excavated. But to do this, he must have the cooperation of the workers, I pointed out.
Men not from the area, so they will be far less likely to report him. Enter Patrick Fairbrother in the guise of Anubis, Stoker said. And whatever usual hazards befall an expedition, illness, accident, they will be chalked up to the malign influence of an offended god. Another clever stroke to buy the silence of his workers.
And if there are not enough hazards to persuade them, such things can easily be arranged, I added. A little arsenic in the teapot can go quite a long way towards conjuring illness. Jonas Fowler died, after all, and John de Morgan was unwell for much of the dig season. Perhaps their misfortunes were helped along by a malicious hand.
But John de Morgan finding the crown and determining it was a fake was something they did not anticipate, Stoker pointed out.
Horace Steele rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
His experience with Egyptology was limited. He wouldn't have known from looking at the diadem that it was fake. Only an expert philologist would have seen the mistake in the inscription. No, I suspect he saw the diadem before it was supposed to have been discovered in the tomb. When it was presented as a great find, he would have realized at once what had happened and taken steps to expose them.
When he left with the diadem, it must have been a brutal blow to the conspirators, I said, carefully avoiding Sir Leicester's name so as not to set Figgy off again. They had to act in order to prevent him from exposing their plot. John de Morgan had to die, and his death would be attributed to the curse of the mummy. Horace Steele broke in with a frown.
It all makes perfect sense until that point. We know he went as far as the hotel in Dover, but no further. How could anyone anticipate where he would go and arrange for his disappearance so thoroughly that his room vanished as well?
That we have yet to discover, I told him. But there is one more little mystery I think we might be able to clear up now. I brought out the box with its knitted cobra and demonstrated the mechanism for the steels. Your handiwork, I think, Figgy?
Yes, all right, then, she said, a trifle sullenly. I didn't trust you. So many strange things had gone on. I felt horrible, so alone and confused. I didn't understand anything of what was happening. And then the pair of you appeared, and I thought you might somehow be connected. I decided to investigate you a little myself. I went to see Lady Welly, and she said all sorts of nice things about you, which almost made me decide not to leave the box. But I already had it in my pocket, and I thought if you got a good fright, it might shake things up a bit. She broke off, but no fresh weeping ensued. Poor Figgy.
And you thought to shake things up even more by having Henry dress up and play Anubis. Is that it?
Stoker asked her. She nodded.
No one tells me anything, she said, her chin taking a suddenly stubborn cast. They treat me like I'm a child, but I'm not. I even tried following Patrick one night, but all he did was visit a house in Kensington off the Cromwell Road, so I met Henry in secret and asked him to help me.
Stoker flicked a glance my way but said nothing. Figgy did not know what she had seen, but the visit to the Marshwoods was significant. It meant that Fairbrother had at the very least broken into Caroline's rooms in an attempt to recover the diadem. I thought of Birdie's observation that Figgy had gone out only to walk the dog, and realized how much she had actually accomplished in those stolen moments.
"And I was happy to,"
Henry said, his manner stalwart. He was every inch the young St. George, willing to slay the dragon for a maiden. And yet I rather suspected that Figgy had taken a more active role than any helpless maiden. If she hadn't had breasts, she might have played Anubis herself, I decided. It was Henry's physique that dictated his part. There might be steel in his spine, but there was good metal in hers.
"What now?"
Horace demanded.
"We have to find proof," Stoker said flatly. "And we must determine the extent of the conspiracy. We believe there are three conspirators, Sir Leicester, Lady Tiverton, and Patrick Fairbrother. But we do not know who is the mastermind."
"She is," Figgy fairly spat. "My father would not be so evil or so clever as to devise such a scheme, and Patrick is thick as a plank. This is her doing."
"Then we must find the proof," Stoker repeated.
Figgy shook her head.
"You won't. She is too clever,"
she insisted. Horace patted her hand.
"Don't carry on so, Figgy. We will make certain your father is not implicated if he is an innocent man."
I resisted the urge to roll my eyes. Innocent man. When he had carried out at least the scheme to defraud the entire Egyptological community, and possibly had conspired to commit murder. But Mr. Steele had clearly cast himself in the role of surrogate father to Figgy, and was relishing his chance to manage the situation.
"Now, in the morning, I will hire the very best Pinkertons I can find, or whatever they have in London that is the equivalent to them,"
he began. Henry rose.
"No, you won't. Every second counts. Now that Sir Leicester has been taken ill, through my actions I will have to live with the rest of my life,"
he added, with such an air of noble suffering, it would have done credit to Achilles.
"I will find the necessary proof to bring this plot to an end before anyone else is harmed."
He stood tall, his shoulders squared, his jaw firm, his eyes shining, and in that moment I saw his father overcome with emotion. If Henry intended his little display to have a similar effect on Figgy, he was sadly disappointed. She merely huffed out a sigh of irritation, while Horace Steele clasped his son to his manly bosom and choked out a few words of praise. He stepped back and reached into his pocket for a revolver.
"Here, son, you will need this."
Henry Steele blanched, and Stoker reached for the weapon, pocketing it easily.
"Thank you, Mr. Steele. It might come in handy at that."
Horace looked to me.
"I apologize, Miss Speedwell,"
he said in a jocular tone.
"I am afraid I do not have a firearm to spare."
I bared my teeth in a smile. "Do not worry yourself, Mr. Steele. Miss Speedwell does not need one." Chapter 19. We arrived at Karnak Hall after a considerable delay. Mr. Steele promised to escort Figgy back to the Sudbury, and I was not surprised. He was quite solicitous of her, and Henry Steele parted from her with a lingering, tender look. I had little doubt that whatever the conclusion of our perilous adventure, Figgy would land amongst friends. The hall was in shadow when we arrived, and we took full advantage of the dark streets, slipping around to the alley behind. As we turned into the narrow passage, we heard a sudden scuttling.
"Rats!"
I pronounced. But the only creature to emerge was of the two-legged variety. A slim young man with a very white bottom hurried past, hoisting his trousers and muttering curses under his breath. A woman who made her living from the nocturnal arts stepped out from behind a discarded crate, blinking in the lamplight.
"Hello, ducks," she said cordially. "Tuppence each against the wall,"
she said, jerking her chin at the shadows.
"Good evening," Stoker replied. "We are not in need of your services, but I do hope we have not cost you that gentleman's fees."
She grinned and opened her palm, revealing a coin.
"Always get the money up front," she said sagely. "What business have you got here unless it's my sort of business?"
she demanded. "We are in need of a pair of sharp eyes," I told her, pressing another coin into her hand. "Go to the end of the street, and if you see a bobby coming, whistle or sing a little tune." She nodded and warbled a few bars of a popular tune.
"Elsie from Chelsea?" I asked.
"Fitting. Elsie's my name," she replied with a wink.
Stoker thanked her and turned to the back door of Karnak Hall, kneeling down as Henry Steele raised the lamp. Elsie took a lingering look at Stoker's backside and the hard length of his thighs before leaning near me with a conspiratorial leer.
"I said tuppence, but if he wants a go, make it a florin."
I raised a brow. "You have just raised your prices by a factor of 12, I noted. She grinned again.
"I reckon a fellow that good-looking has had his share for free. It might make a change for him to pay well for it."
Stoker smothered a laugh and removed a set of slender metal tools from his pocket and set to work.
"You know how to pick locks?"
Henry demanded. Stoker shrugged.
"I am an experienced surgeon and a taxidermist, lad. Nimble fingers have a number of uses."
Elsie made a noise that could only be rendered as, "Ooh-er." I pressed another coin into her hand. "Have this instead. A peg of gin will keep you warmer than he will.
I am afraid he is shy."
Stoker snorted as the woman pocketed the coin. She tipped her plumed hat.
"Pity, but truth be told, I'd rather have a peg of gin in any event. Thank you kindly, missus. I'll keep an eye at the end of the alley, then."
"You're a good soul, Elsie," she guffawed.
"Don't you believe it, missus, but I'm not as bad as some."
With that, she went on her way, picking a path over lettuce leaves and puddles with the grace of a duchess. "I rather like her," I said, to no one in particular. With a jaunty nod, she headed down the street, positioning herself at the end of the alley as she tucked the evening's earnings away in a pocket beneath her petticoat. Henry Steele turned to me, his eyes wide.
"Was that a fallen woman?"
"I should rather call her an entrepreneur," I told him seriously. We chatted for some minutes while Stoker worked, sharing a frank exchange of views on the state of the current prostitution laws and comparing them with those of ancient Egypt. Young Mr. Steele was informative, rather too much so. I suspected him of having an unhealthy preoccupation with ladies of limited virtue, but before I could provide him with a lecture upon the subject, Stoker interrupted.
"I am in,"
Stoker called softly. Henry stared at him in frank admiration.
"You must teach me how to do that,"
he said. "No time," I answered, pushing him after Stoker into the darkened building. I paused to wave to Elsie, who returned the gesture, moving briskly off into the night as we pulled the door closed behind us. Deserted, the lavish lamps extinguished, Karnak Hall was an atmospheric place. The very air seemed expectant, and I was deeply conscious of the eyes watching us. Painted, sculpted eyes of every description peering out from the vitrines as we passed from shadow to shadow. The light from the single lantern scarcely penetrated the gloom, but it was enough to illuminate Henry Steele's white face. "Steady, Mr. Steele," I said softly. He nodded once, squaring his shoulders. He was a stalwart fellow, young Henry Steele, and I hoped his nerve would not desert him. The dais was empty now, the princess's sarcophagus having been moved. "She'll be in the storage room," I told Stoker, motioning for him to follow. I led the way to the corridor where I had first encountered her. The door, not surprisingly, was locked, but Stoker bent once more to employ his larcenous talents and we were soon inside. The sarcophagus rested on trestles, its surface glimmering in the fitful light. Next to it, propped against the wall, stood a sturdy wooden packing crate, spilling forth a heap of excelsior, its lid askew. I stooped to read the label affixed to one of the boards. "This is the sarcophagus crate. The label on it says that the mummy case came through Dover," I told Stoker, not even daring to voice the rest of my suspicion. I did not have to. With that curious sort of telepathy that we shared upon occasion, Stoker intuited my thoughts. He sighed and stripped off his coat.
"I will find a crowbar," he said. "What is it?" Henry asked in mystification.
I gave him a pitying look. "I suggest you take out your handkerchief, Mr. Steele, and tie it bandit fashion about your nose. This is not going to be pleasant."
"What isn't?"
he demanded.
"What have you found?"
Stoker reappeared, tool in hand, and applied himself. It took considerable effort, and in the end Henry and I both had to throw our weight against the lid of the sarcophagus to help budge it. When we did, a noxious odour rolled out, and Henry reeled away, gagging like a cat.
"Good God, what is that terrible smell?"
he asked, between heaves into one of the potted palms. "That," I said simply, "is what is left of John de Morgan." I had not considered what it might mean to Stoker to uncover the remains of his former best friend, and there was no time to consider it after. "Well," I pronounced, "this is all the proof we need. We will go directly to the Metropolitan Police and tell them what we have discovered. Surely that will be enough." Just as Mr. Steele collected his composure, there was a sharp intake of breath from the doorway. We turned as one to see Patrick Fairbrother standing there, a lamp held high in his hand. How grotesque the scene must have appeared to him. We had set our lantern on the floor, and the shadows it cast onto the ceiling were enormous. We stood crowded around the mummy case, its lid askew, and the odour of John de Morgan's decomposing corpse filling the air. Without a word, he backed away, throwing the door shut. Before we could spring into action, we heard the sound of a key in the lock.
"Helen damnation!"
Stoker swore. He turned to me.
"I believe we have just lost the element of surprise." "What now?"
Henry Steele asked, his eyes rounded.
"Can you pick the lock?"
Stoker gave him a kindly smile.
"Rather pointless from this side."
I eyed the ventilator high in the wall. "That is the only way. A boost, if you please, Stoker." He set his foot on a crate, providing me with the sturdy length of his thigh as a perch. I mounted it, pushing myself to my full height until my fingertips reached the grate covering the ventilator. I wrenched it free. "Catch, if you will, Mr. Steele." Young Henry caught it, watching in rapt fascination as Stoker hoisted me higher, pushing firmly on my posterior as I inserted myself into the passage of the ventilator.
"Is there sufficient room, Miss Speedwell?" Henry called.
"Perfectly. It is so capacious I might just set up housekeeping," I called, more out of bravado than truth. If I am honest, the space was narrow enough to cause my chest to tighten uncomfortably. The passage itself was not so small as to constrict me, but the feeling of imperfect liberty was alarming. I had little experience of caves. Butterfly hunting, of necessity, takes place in meadows. But I was not certain a familiarity with enclosed spaces would help. Only resolve and discipline would carry the day, I reflected. I put my head down and crawled, as quickly as I could manage, wedging myself through a bend in the shaft until a lacy pattern of light showed that I had come to another cover. I punched it hard, dropping it to the floor below, and hesitated. If it led to another locked storeroom, I would be no better off, and indeed worse, for I would be separated from my companions with no means of communicating with them. But every second's lead Patrick Fairbrother had upon us was another second lost. I turned myself with a great deal of trouble and fluent swearing until my feet were above the ventilator. With a murmured prayer, I kicked hard, forcing it loose. I dropped through the opening, clasping the edge of it as my body dangled free. A quick glance revealed I was in the corridor, and Patrick Fairbrother was nowhere to be seen. I dropped to my feet, hurrying to the storeroom where Stoker and Henry were still imprisoned. "I am free," I called.
"I presume the devil has taken the key," Stoker replied, his casual drawl muffled by the stout door.
"Yes, and I don't suggest you try to batter your way free. This door is proper oak, nothing like those flimsy things upstairs."
"I have already made that observation," he countered. "Now, take out two hairpins and I will explain to you exactly what to do next."
The process was not so straightforward as either of us would have liked. Stoker's instructions were hampered by the sound-smothering quality of the door, and it was several minutes before we realized that his directions were transposed in my hands.
"Of all the wool-headed, cotton-witted stupidity," he grumbled, "of course you ought to have reversed the instructions."
"It might have behooved you to mention that sooner," I countered icily, "and perhaps you could be a trifle more gracious when I am in the process of a rescue." With that, I set myself once more to the task of liberation, and within a considerably longer period than I would have preferred, the lock yielded.
"At last,"
Stoker said, brushing the dust from his sleeves with studied nonchalance. "Quiet, or I shall bolt you back in." Our eyes locked. "To the Sudbury?" I asked.
"Where else?"
Unfortunately, it was the time of day when the streets are most mightily clogged with traffic, hansoms and hackneys jostling with dray wagons and omnibuses as the population of London moves hither and thither. We attempted for some time to hail a cab, but in the end we were forced to make our way on foot, arriving at the Sudbury breathless and in some disarray. Lady Tiverton opened the door of the suite, her expression grim.
"Thank God you've come," she said fervently. "Help us, I beg you."
Figgy stood behind her, pale and distraught. "Where is Patrick Fairbrother?" I demanded. "He is responsible for the death of John de Morgan, and we mean to see justice done."
"Then you must hurry," Lady Tiverton said.
"You have to do something about father," Figgy burst out, He's gone mad.
He has not gone mad, Lady Tiverton corrected with some severity. But he is not himself.
What has happened? We cannot help if we don't know exactly what's gone on,
Stoker told her calmly. She made an effort to compose herself. She turned to her stepdaughter.
Figgy, ring for tea, please.
I don't want bloody tea,
Figgy yelled, stamping her foot.
Iphigenia,
her stepmother said, in a commanding tone I had never heard her use before.
You will control yourself and be useful, or I will slap you. Hysterics will solve nothing. Tea, now.
To my astonishment, Figgy obeyed. Henry hurried after her, and that left Stoker and me to learn what we could.
Figgy has told me some of what has passed, and I know she suspects me of complicity in this plot. I can tell you that nothing could be further from the truth. I only today learned the full extent of what has been happening, when my husband and Patrick nearly came to blows, not an hour ago in this very room. They have gone to the country house. To Surrey, she said, clasping her hands together. I believe something terrible is going to happen.
To which of them?
Stoker asked shrewdly. She flinched.
To my husband. He is not a criminal. He is not hard, she protested. Patrick will harm him. Right now, Sir Leicester believes he has Patrick in his power. But I know Patrick will find a way to turn the tables on him.
Fairbrother means to double-cross him?
Stoker suggested.
That's what Sir Leicester believes, she said, her lips tightening. They were equal partners in the scheme, but my husband has come to think that Patrick means to cheat him of his share.
Why does he believe that?
Stoker asked.
I went to Patrick's room, she said, forcing the words through stiff lips. I searched his things, and among his papers I found a ticket on a steamship leaving tomorrow. He means to go to South America, the Argentine. I also found a packet of powder, she added, her dark eyes enormous in her face. I think it might be a poison of some sort. Heaven only knows what he did, or means to do, with it.
I turned to Stoker and mouthed the words, Jonas Fowler? He gave a single sharp nod of the head. Lady Tiverton went on.
I took the ticket and the packet to my husband to persuade him that Patrick was working against him, to show him what Patrick really was. I told him we could confront Patrick together, force him to give up his share, and go quietly, without making a scandal. But Sir Leicester would not hear of it. He left his sickbed, and took a revolver to force Patrick to go with him to Surrey.
Why Surrey? I inquired.
Tiverton Hall is my husband's country house in Surrey. That is where the rest of the artifacts are being kept, the ones they intend to sell,
she explained swiftly.
Sir Leicester thinks the inventory may have been cleared away, and he wants to see for himself. You must stop him before he does something rash.
We will pursue them,
Stoker promised.
But they left on the last train, she said, spreading her hands. There is not another until morning.
Oh, for God's sake, I muttered. We are no rescue mission. On this investigation we have already been half-drowned, very nearly burnt to death, and almost suffocated in a sewer. A sudden movement in the doorway caught my attention.
Please,
Figgy begged, tears springing to her eyes as she came forwards.
You must help. He is my father.
Her voice broke on the last syllable, and I knew better than to fight. Stoker could resist many things, but a desolate girl trying to save her father from himself was not one of them. Very well, I consoled her. We will do something. But what? Hired carriage?
Horses will never beat the train,
Stoker said, stroking his chin thoughtfully.
But I know something that will.
I stared at the Montgolfier balloon.
You must be joking.
I am not,
Stoker said with maddening calm.
It is ready to fly. I meant to take it up and test it again this week in any event, and it is our only chance to reach the Tiverton House tonight. We even have the wind on our side, and that is miracle enough.
I looked to Henry Steele, who had blanched to marble white in the moonlight. I sighed. Come on, then. If we are to die, let us do it like men, and Englishmen at that. We decided to bring Henry because he knew the whereabouts of the Tiverton country estate, and Figgy's desperate pleading had roused Lady Welly to action. She turned every able-bodied male servant at Bishop's Folly out of bed, and directed them with all the august authority of her namesake, ordering them to follow Stoker as if he were leading a charge. While the men assembled, Stoker and I hastily dressed in our warmest garments, precaution against the chill of aeronautic flight. Over the top of my costume I wrapped a shawl, tucking the ends firmly into my belt, and Stoker unearthed an unlikely bit of bearskin for Henry Steele to wear like a cloak. Once we were kitted, Stoker organized the workers into groups to man the ropes and smooth the envelope of the balloon. He climbed into the gondola, directing Henry and me where to stand so that the weight would be evenly distributed, with the clever addition of appropriately positioned sandbags. Stoker and Henry fired up the brazier themselves, pouring coal into it until slowly, almost imperceptibly at first, the balloon began to fill. The silk moved slowly, coming to life as the air moved into its great lung, drawing in the warmth that would cause it to lift. I watched, gripping my hands together in suppressed excitement as it grew, rising and rounding until it rose above the treetops, a grand spectacle of a balloon, emblazoned with the ciphers of a long-dead king, a ghost of Versailles, rising above the heart of Marylebone. The gondola stood expectantly on the grass, quivering in anticipation, and I climbed into the basket with Stoker and Henry. At a signal from Stoker, the lads on the ground let go of the ropes, and the basket rose, slowly and gracefully as a dancer. The fellows below waved their caps and cheered, and Lady Welly waved her walking stick. Next to her, Figgy did not move, her pale face upturned to watch us as we drifted away. Stoker made a few adjustments, and we were turned towards the south. Cruising above the sleeping city, we sailed noiselessly through the night sky, to the river and past the Houses of Parliament. The face of the great Westminster clock glowed white in its golden tower, and high above it hung the Ayrton light, its green glitter proclaiming that Parliament was still sitting. We sailed past it, silent as a ghost in the clear, star-flung night. Over the River Thames and above the south bank, we glided until we came at last to the countryside, a vast stretch of darkness rippling below. It was punctuated here and there with shimmering dots of the firefly lights of a town, but for the most part, all was quiet and dark, rural England tucked peacefully into bed on a late winter night. The air was bitterly cold, and I was grateful for the warmth of the brazier. The chill of the February air gave us good lift, and occasionally Stoker and Henry paused in their frenetic feeding of the brazier to watch as England unfurled below us. illuminated by the gentle glow of the full moon behind us. From time to time, the air in the balloon would cool, causing us to drop suddenly, and my stomach would swoop within me, creating a rush of exhilaration like that of riding a fast horse, or standing on the deck of a boat with full-bellied sails. I loved every minute of that strange adventure, and more than once I looked across to find Stoker grinning at me in the hellfire of the brazier. I smiled back at him, reveling in our new adventure. Poor Henry Steele did not fare quite so well. The unaccustomed motion of the flight drove him to lean over the side of the gondola more than once, emptying the contents of his stomach with audible groans.
"This is lunacy," he moaned. "The wildest of goose chases. How can we possibly hope to find them?"
"Courage, Mr. Steele," I said, passing him the flask of aguardiente to bolster his nerve. He took it and swallowed deeply, gasping and spluttering as he pursed it back. For a moment I thought he would succumb to his fright, but he rallied, and I believed then that his father would be proud of him. The odds that we would spy them in the dark serenity of that March night were incalculable, but I have always enjoyed uncommonly good fortune at the most unlikely of times. Through some means—divine providence, luck, Stoker's earnest efforts—we at last spotted the train below us, speeding through the countryside, the engine exhaling great puffs of steam. I thought of Patrick Fairbrother and Sir Leicester Tiverton and the confrontation to come. Would either of them welcome us? Would we bring deliverance or destruction?
"There,"
Henry cried, pointing to a bend in a narrow river.
"My God, I cannot believe it, but just there, where the river turns back on itself, that is Tiverton Hall. Where the moonlight is showing a broad, flat bit of ground is a lawn in the front, and you can land there."
Stoker did as Henry directed, maneuvering the balloon to the boundary of the trees that marched to the edge of the manicured lawns. He intended for us to skim gently down, as easily as a butterfly alights on a branch. But our luck did not hold. The balloon had other ideas. The gondola came down with a precipitous drop, the treetops rushing up at us at dizzying speed.
"Up, Stoker!" I urged.
"For God's sake, I'm trying," he said through gritted teeth,
tinkering with the brazier to send more heat into the envelope. But it was too late. There followed a series of sickening shudders as the gondola cracked its way through the canopy, breaking branches on its way down. Broken limbs clawed the sides of the basket, reaching, grasping, as we hurtled down. Down, down, faster and faster. I braced myself for the inevitable crash, and with a sickening thud, we jolted to a stop. The balloon had been snagged upon the trees, and we dangled there in the gondola like so much ripe fruit, some 40 feet above the ground. Henry peeped over the edge of the basket and gave a low moan of anguish. Stoker immediately tossed one of the guy ropes out and grunted with satisfaction when it fell just short of the ground.
"We shall have to climb for it,"
he announced. Henry made a sound of protest, but just then the basket slid a little as the wind rocked the trees. I patted his shoulder.
"Never mind. It's best if you don't look down, and if you break a leg, Stoker can always put you down. He's got the revolver, after all."
Henry gave me a look of purest loathing, and I shrugged at Stoker. But the goad worked. Without further ado, Henry put his leg over the side of the basket, grasping the rope in what must have been nerveless fingers. I did not watch. But the sudden snapping of a branch and a thud, followed by a groan of pain, were eloquent. I peered down into the darkness.
"Mr. Steele? I say, Mr. Steele, are you quite all right?"
"I believe I have broken my arm," he called,
in a voice very unlike his usual.
"Well, that is unfortunate," I observed.
"Your turn," Stoker said.
"I think not," I replied in indignation. "I am lighter. I should remain behind, since the gondola is unstable and might topple at any moment. I stand a better chance of surviving a fall than you do." His expression was inscrutable.
"I am, for all intents and purposes, captain of this endeavor. If anyone is going down with the ship, it is I. Now get down that rope before I toss you out."
He advanced upon me as if to make good on his threat, and I vaulted over the edge of the gondola, gripping the rope with my hands and tightening my legs around it. I lowered myself in a steady rhythm, ignoring the creaks and groans of protest from the branches above. They were holding the balloon, but barely. My boot tips hovered above the ground, and I dropped from the rope to find Henry staring at me in frank admiration, even as he clutched his arm to his chest.
"Where did you learn to climb like that?"
he demanded. "On vines in Costa Rica. The best butterfly habitats are notoriously inaccessible. Do you require medical assistance, Mr. Steele?" I asked. He shook his head manfully.
"No, I can manage."
He struggled to sit, then to stand. His broken arm was folded like a bird's wing against his chest. I removed my shawl and knotted it tightly about his neck, forming a snug cradle for his injured limb. "There you are," I pronounced. "And mind you see that shawl gets back to me. It is my favorite." He nodded, smiling weakly as I lifted my face to call, "Come on then, Stoker, we haven't all night." Stoker appeared over the edge of the basket and wound one leg about the rope, gripping it with the expert technique of a man who has spent years aboard Her Majesty's ships as a naval officer. His weight, greater than mine or Henry's, and possibly both together, caused the gondola to tip perilously. The branches holding the balloon cracked, and the ominous sound of ripping silk shredded the night. "Faster," I urged under my breath. He moved fluidly, unhurried. He was still more than 30 feet from the ground, and a drop from there could kill him. But he would do far better without distraction from below, so I restricted my comments to muttering under my breath. There was a long, slow sound, like a seamstress ripping calico. Then a breathless pause. Stoker looked up, and before I could shout a warning, the last of the branches broke with a crack so loud it sounded like a cannon shot. Stoker, the rope, the basket, the balloon, all came tumbling to the ground in a rush of wicker and silk, landing with an audible thud that shook the earth. "Stoker!" I could not see him, for the balloon had landed in a riot of destruction. It took a moment for the silk to settle, and the silence was ominous. Suddenly, the pile gave a great heave, and Stoker emerged, crawling free of the debris. He coughed heavily, clutching his side. "You've no doubt broken a rib," I scolded. "You ought to have descended before the balloon had a chance to tear." He looked up at me, wheezing heavily, and I realized he was laughing.
"It is no more than cracked, you virago. Good God, a man could die and you would scold him for making a mess on the carpet. Never change, Veronica."
"I shouldn't dream of it," I promised him, "although what I am to do with a pair of wounded combatants I cannot begin to think. Perhaps you should give me the revolver after all," I suggested brightly.
"Not bloody likely," Stoker muttered.
I helped him to his feet and saw the grimace of pain he tried to suppress. I did not fuss. We had a mission, and he would not thank me to distract him from it with talk of broken bones and bandages.
"They have just entered the house,"
Henry called in a hoarse whisper. Following Henry's lead, we crept near to Tiverton Hall, It might, at one time, have been a pretty Tudor manor, but the gardens had been left untended and the building itself showed signs of neglect. Sir Leicester had obviously poured every spare penny into his Egypt